Today, working with Oliver Reed and Michael Winner and meeting Gene Kelly for Hello Dolly. All together now, put on your Sunday clothes when you feel down and out. Here's the star.
There are some wonderful people in this world, great caricature figures who, no matter their profession, are quite larger than life. High on my list is the film director, Michael Winner. Almost anyone who has worked with Michael has all kinds of war stories to tell about the experience. He can be rude, arrogant, and outrageous, but I like him, and I like the way he gets things done. I first met him in 1966. We had a meeting to discuss a film he had written with Dick Clement and Ian LaFrenay called The Jokers. We met at Michael Winner's London office, a beautifully appointed room filled with handsome antiques and a huge desk. He appeared to be supremely confident and comfortable amidst all the opulence. When he rises to speak, he stands quite round-shouldered, in the shape of a comma holding a big cigar. He puffs furiously, rocking back and forth on his heels, while his hands constantly jingle whatever he happens to find in his pockets. When he's excited about something, he paces the room like a well-tailored wading bird, head pulled into hunched shoulders, his free hand placed palm up and neatly folded behind him while a lead toe tentatively steps forward, daubing the carpet as if to test some sandy shoreline before his trailing leg and upper torso can be pulled forward to join the rest of him. He was pacing in this way as he told me about The Jokers. "It's a marvellous story, my dear. Everyone is always his dear. All about two brothers who set about stealing the crown jewels from the Tower of London." I asked him the obvious question, "Who's going to play my brother?" "Oliver Reed," he said. "Oliver Reed?" Enter here my second nomination for that list of unforgettable, larger-than-life characters. He died this year at the age of 61, far too young. I came to know firsthand how very seriously he took his work. But Oliver Reed as my brother, I really dug my heels in on that one. There was absolutely no way I thought an audience would ever accept Oliver Reed and me as being even remotely related. Because of this, I kept finding excuses not to do the film, questioning absolutely everything in the script. During a meeting with Ian LaFrenay and Dick Clement in Winner's office, the writers irritably asked, "Who in hell does Michael Crawford think he is? Jesus Christ!" Michael Winner, without a beat, replied, "He might well be, my dears, he might well be. Keep writing just in case." It was finally fixed that I should meet Ollie, and his brother was to be present as well. I'll never forget the shock when he turned up. His brother was fair and skinny. He could have been my double. There were no more arguments. However, depending upon how he was cast at the time, I think it's fair to say there was always a certain amount of physical risk present when you worked with Oliver Reed. The problem was that he tended to live the part he was playing. I'm thankful he played my brother in The Jokers. Whenever we walked about the set together, he always kept a fraternal arm around me, and every now and again he'd give me a brotherly squeeze, the kind of squeeze a fruit-extracting machine would give to a ripe orange. The only sticky moment between us came during the filming of a scene where the script called for Ollie to half-strangle me. In the story, his brother had supposedly betrayed him. I was really dreading it. Quite rightly. Because as we shot the scene, Oliver took my betrayal as something entirely real and completely personal, and suddenly my life wasn't worth tuppence. His ham-like hands were fastened so tightly around my neck, I felt the end of my life was imminent. It took four people to get him off me, and only two of them were scripted. Michael Winner ran a tight set on The Jokers and exercised a strong grip over cast and crew, whose mood alternated between hating him for his personal outbursts and admiring him for his technical flair. We were always concocting pranks to play on him. He was the perfect target. We painted the mouthpiece on his megaphone with shoe polish. He made him look as if he were Al Jolson, about to break into a chorus of Swanee. And it didn't take much coaxing from Ollie to convince the crew to hoist Michael's car up on bricks one night. Michael had just returned from a location site. "All right," he screamed at the departing company. "I want a better day than we had today." Yeah, everybody muttered. He climbed into the car and his driver prepared to drive off, but the wheels began to spin. The car didn't move. The engine stopped. The door swung open and Michael clambered out and into his Bantam Rooster walk, charging the crew. "Who did this? Who the hell did this?" Everybody scattered. I'm fairly certain the success of The Jokers in New York was instrumental in bringing my name into a casting discussion for a play scheduled to open on Broadway in February 1967. Peter Shaffer's one-act piece, Black Comedy. It was his first attempt at broad farce and a great success. Certainly I wanted to go to America. I'd always dreamed of making my mark on the Broadway stage, but I boarded the plane for New York with very mixed feelings. I hated the thought of being away from Gabrielle and missing our daughter Emma's first Christmas, but I simply couldn't afford to bring them with me at that point. In Black Comedy, Peter Shaffer employed a device hilariously staged by our director John Dexter, which was used by the ancient Chinese in their theatre. All the play's characters behaved as though they were in a pitch-dark room, blindly bumbling around and crashing into furniture. But all the while, the stage lights were actually on, giving the audience a full view of the action. The setup was simple enough. The curtain goes up, the scene is dark. Everything is reversed, you see. A fuse blows. The lights go out. But on stage, they actually light up, and for the rest of the evening, we stumble about in supposed total darkness. The staging was dotted with some wonderful visual gags. I had a particular piece of business where I had to attempt to grope my way blindly across the stage, one foot at a time, feeling my way to a platform some 6 inches off the floor. When I reached the platform, I climbed on it, but accidentally stood on a carefully placed telephone, which slid across the platform, carrying me with it, and resulting in a spectacular pratfall. Just to put the lid on it, the doorbell rings and I quickly and blindly walk towards the door, hitting the door jamb straight in the middle of my forehead and bouncing off it a full 5 yards. There was a cushioned foam inset that my head hit, so it wasn't quite as painful as it sounds. Still, I managed to concuss myself a couple of times. Before I left Black Comedy, I had the pleasure of meeting an immensely talented Texan named Roger Edens, who came backstage one night to talk about his latest project. He'd just been named associate producer for the 20th Century Fox film production of Hello, Dolly. It was Roger who arranged for me to audition with Dolly's director, Gene Kelly, which completely changed my life. I was asked to go with Dick Lester to San Francisco to promote How I Won the War, one of his movies I'd appeared in, and it was arranged that I should meet Gene Kelly during my 3-day stay in California. The words sound so matter-of-fact, but let me tell you, just the anticipation of meeting Gene Kelly was enough to tie me in knots. The flight from London arrived in San Francisco late at night, and the jet lag was excruciating. But there was absolutely no way I could sleep. When I arrived at the hotel, there was a message waiting for me. "Gene Kelly called. We'll call later." I've still got that piece of paper. My God, how could I ever throw it away? Gene Kelly called me. The Gene Kelly called me. Michael Crawford. His representative eventually rang to say Mr. Kelly would meet me at the hotel at 10 in the morning. Of course, I'm up at 6. I have a long bath to try and kill some time. I figure that will take an hour if I wash my hair and I have a shave. All right, all done. I get dressed. It's 7:10. I need a project, something to do. I know, maybe another bath. But this time I'll try it in slow motion. I undress and start the process again and slowly wash my hair. 8:15. Nervous hysteria begins, its steady march across my brain. Still hours to go. Grasping for any project to keep my mind off the time, I change clothes again and think, no, this isn't smart enough for Gene Kelly. I change again, then change back. I only have 3 sets of clothes. In those mod days, everything was different stripes and patterns. Outrageous stuff. I'm still changing as the doorbell rings. Standing in check jacket, floral shirt, and striped pants. Ugh. I open the door and see that famous genial Irish grin. Gene Kelly stands there. Oh, I croaked. That was his first sight and sound of me. He walked into my room and never took his eyes off me. I think he thought I was going to pull a knife on him. Not that it would have bothered him. He was obviously in much better condition than the pipe cleaner in pants who stood before him. Do sit down, I stuttered. He was already sitting. Right, I said. I will too. Let's cut the small talk, he said. He apparently wasn't going to waste time asking if I'd had a good trip or if I'd arrived in one piece. He obviously knew I'd arrived. Whether I was all there mentally was the question in his mind. Can you dance? He asked. Well, actually, I tried to relax and nonchalantly threw one arm around the back of the couch. It missed, and my elbow bounced off my knee. How in hell can I tell him I haven't danced a step in my life? There was an odd look on his face. What have I got here? I've traveled all the way from Los Angeles to see this. Actually, Mr. Kelly, I'm not known for my dancing. Well, what are you known for? He said. Well, nothing, really. Then he said, well, listen, could you try something? Maybe give me a few steps. What, now? Immediately? Well, yes, he said. Just get up and do something. Try this. He got up on the coffee table and did a couple of tap steps. Oh, that, I said, now truly panicked. Right. I got up and bumbled around until finally I came to a pathetic halt. I'm afraid, I said. Not doing too well, am I? Looks as though... Sit down, he said. Right. I'm sit down, I said. What we're looking for here, he said, is for someone to play Cornelius Hackle. He's an attractive idiot. He paused. Now my wife, well, she thinks you're attractive, and I think you're an idiot. So between us, I think you could be exactly right for this film. What I want you to do is to go back to England and make a test. I want you to sing It Only Takes a Moment. I'll find someone to teach you to dance. Do some steps, sing the song, and send it back. We'll show it to the producers, and I can have a look at you. Oh, thank you. Thank you so very much. I shook his hand almost off the end of his arm. When he finally managed to extricate himself, he walked out of the door and down the corridor. I swear I heard him talking to himself.